Well, members, I'd like to call the committee to order. We'll start with, and hopefully we'll have a few people joining us as the day goes on, or as the hour goes on. I'd like to, Representative Pepin moves the minutes of January 10th, and all those in favor of approving the minutes say, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, the same. Having done that, I guess we're going to approve the minutes. I'm going to get this out of the way because if I don't, I'll forget. Today we're going to have the University of Minnesota and their bioscience division come in today. We have Dr. Frank Serra and Dr. Tim Mulcahy, good Irish name, present to us what the university is doing with their bioscience and their technologies over at the campus. This is part one of a two-part overview of it. I've been involved with it for a good number of years over there at the U, and then with the Rochester Mayo partnership with the U. I think this is an important place for the state to go, and I'm grateful that you could take your time to get here today and give us an overview. So with that being said, if you'd introduce yourself for the record and proceed, we'll move forward.
Thank you, Chair Mahoney. And members of the committee, my name is Frank Serra. I'm the Senior Vice President for Health Sciences at the University.
And I'm Tim Mulcahy. I'm the Vice President for Research at the University of Minnesota.
And we have two professors with us today who will speak to you briefly at a point in this presentation about some specific biotechnology. One is Professor Erdman from the Institute of Technology, and the other is Professor Ecker from the Medical School, which will begin to emphasize to you one of our big goals of moving the medical school and the Institute of Technology and Health Sciences and the Institute of Technology closer together. Today's presentation will really cover the depth and breadth of biotechnology at the university, or biosciences, I should say, that which ends up as biotechnology. And we will also emphasize workforce and how we are preparing the workforce that is going to be needed to capture the value of that biosciences research. And tomorrow, Vice President Mulcahy will walk you through more of all the very good things he's doing to improve relationships with industry and to commercialize that technology. So with that, Vice President Mulcahy will begin the presentation. If you have questions along the way, please ask, or we're certainly going to try and leave sufficient time at the end for whatever dialogue you would wish. Tim?
Chair Mahoney and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to share with you today the role of the university in the biosciences economy of the state of Minnesota. I'm just going to start very quickly with a reminder slide of a summary of the university's mission, which really is research, education, and outreach. And in each case, this is a different facet of knowledge creation and dissemination. And we view our role very significantly in contributing to the generation of new knowledge and innovation, which feeds the bioscience economy of Minnesota, the education or dissemination of that knowledge to our students who become the workforce in the state of Minnesota and elsewhere, and the importance of outreach, our translating what we do in the university to impact everyone's lives, which is another very important role for the university with regard to the citizens in the state. This has been the university's land-grant mission since 1862, when the land-grant university was initiated at the University of Minnesota. This slide is just to try to capture quickly for you where the University of Minnesota sits with respect to the continuum from innovation and development of new discovery through to the point that there's actually economic benefit and quality of life impact for consumers. And you can see that the university really sits at the innovation end of this economy, and it's really our role to make new discoveries, to develop new technologies, and to advance innovation, which then serves as the nucleus for the growth and evolution of the technologies and industries and businesses in the state of Minnesota and nationally. We're a very important partner in job creations in the state in the sense that what we do as an innovator has profound impact on industry and the workforce that supports that industry in the state. I'd like to just very briefly give you a thumbnail view of the university with regard to its research responsibility and role, and would point out that the University of Minnesota is the only research university in the state of Minnesota. Unlike many of our peers, states across the nation, who have multiple research universities, the University of Minnesota is the research university in this state and accounts for greater than 98% of all the research fundings to universities in the state. In 2006, we had over $500 million in annual research expenditures, and we anticipate, in fact, we know that portfolio is growing. Most importantly, with regard to our role in the biosciences, is that the university has a comprehensive array of research fields. Unlike many research universities across the nation, the University of Minnesota has the full array of biosciences incorporated in the university. So it makes it easy for us to make significant contributions and actually puts an obligation on us to fulfill our commitment to many, many aspects of biosciences that benefit the state. Overall, the university is the eighth ranked public university in terms of research volume and the 17th overall out of a total of 505 universities in this ranking system. So the university is a premier research university. It's recognized as such nationally and has that kind of local and national impact.
Dr. Mulcahy, if I could just stop you there for a second, because I got a substantial number of questions on the paper that was put out a couple of days ago. And I know we had a conversation, but if you could share your thoughts on that particular study with the committee as a whole, I could at least direct one or two of those questions to other committee members so I wouldn't have to spend that much time explaining it.
Chair Mahoney, would you like me to do that at this point?
I think it's an appropriate time with the research funds and talking about where we're ranked.
Great. The report in question was published probably a week ago, a week and a half ago, by one of our applied economists, and Phil Pardee. And basically the synopsis of that report indicated that the university's research ranking among its peers has been sliding over the last 10 to 20 years. And although I've listed here for you that we rank 8, previously, at one point 20 years ago, we ranked number 2. So there's been some erosion in our collective standing in that group. That report, however, I think overstated a certain significance of that decline in stating that it indicated that the University of Minnesota was no longer above average. And what I would point out to you is we were no longer above average amongst the group of universities we selected to compare ourselves to, which were included in that study, 14 of the elite universities in the country. Our growth rate was lower than the average in that group, but our growth rate is greater than the average overall. And to put it in perspective, I would say that if you were a sprinter who happened to be in the field of 14 in the gold medal round at the Olympics, and you finished out of the medals, I don't think the conclusion would be that you are not an average runner. I think the point to make here is that the group we selected to compare ourselves to in that study is the best of the best. And the university ranks incredibly well in that group. It's just that there are signs that our ability to keep up with them are beginning to erode. And it's really a message, I think, that says we need additional support and long-term commitment so that we can plan effectively, and that's the basis of some of what we'll be presenting to you today. But I think it would be unfair to conclude from that report that the University of Minnesota is anything other than a premier research university, tops in its rank. I think it's also unfair if we were to say that we're in a position to maintain that status without some significant change in terms of how we plan and support the university long term.
Kind of like a $310 million research grant.
Right.
For buildings.
Yeah. Along that line.
Thank you.
And what I can tell you is, going back to that analogy of being an Olympic sprinter, we're not happy finishing 7th or 8th in that field of 14. We want to finish in the medals. But we need some continued support. We're grateful for the support we have received from the state, but we're advancing some initiatives that we believe will really advance this particular agenda to the state's benefit.
Chair Mahoney, if I might add a comment to Vice President Mulcahy, I think part of the another part of that message, it's kind of looking at the coin on the opposite side, is our competition, and we'll speak more about this later, for the research dollars is making major investments in other states that are outstripping what the state of Minnesota, public and private sectors of the state of Minnesota, are making. The most recent announcement is what Harvard is doing to put all its biosciences in a huge development. And you go from there and you go to California, where you've heard about the billions of dollars. And it's that investment that we're really talking about needing, part of which is the Biomedical Facilities Authority and part of which is the faculty who really do the work. So I just want to put that context there.
Dr. Sarek and Dr. Mulcahy, I'm sure you'll explain it even more in depth as you meet with all of us, so privately.
Did that answer satisfy? Thank you very much. We'll just go ahead. This is, again, just by way of introduction. The university's $500 million research portfolio, 70% of it comes from competitive grants through the federal government. We have state-supported research to a total of about 8%. Private meaning foundations and for example, the American Cancer Society and things like that, about 13%. And industrial-sponsored research, totaling 8%. And it's some of these particular distributions that we're also looking at adjusting with regard to new university policy and outlook, which we'll share with you tomorrow as well. We want to see improvements in all of these particular sectors of our research portfolio, as we believe it's important to the state. I just very quickly also like, more as a preamble for tomorrow, but it also sets the stage to what we want to talk about today, is give you a look at the concept of moving ideas out of the university to market. As I mentioned in an earlier slide, we're at the very beginning, the discovery end of this progression from idea to market. And most of the idea or discovery-based research is sponsored by the federal government and others on the basis of really basic research, not necessarily a research project with a particular application in mind. At some point, the innovations we come up with, and you'll hear some examples from my colleagues, these ideas are ready for market and offer great benefit to people in terms of quality of life, but also to a state and region in terms of economic development. The problem is there's this gap that exists between what the federal government and many of our basic research funders will provide support for and when a company or a business is ready to invest money in it in terms of the production and marketing. It creates a gap that the federal government isn't really ready to support, and which is too early for investors to support. So right in the middle of this important lifeline is a gap that needs to be addressed. And I'll talk to you tomorrow a little bit more about innovation funding, but there are opportunities also through state support to provide support to the university that would allow us to bridge this critical gap for technologies that are important to the state. Finally, let me just go to this and say, what is the university's role in supporting research? What we as an institution need to do is build effective corridors that integrate discovery and application of the knowledge. We have to recruit and support the most capable faculty, such as my colleagues who are joining me at the table now. We have to enhance the translational pipeline to be more efficient and effective. I'll detail this more for you tomorrow, but the university needs to be very deliberate about making that connection from its innovation and discovery to potential application for economic benefit. We have to leverage our research strengths, making smart investments in ways that would also benefit the state, align some of our investments and developments with needs in the state of Minnesota. We have to set a research performance expectation that all faculty, staff, and administrators need to satisfy in order to move the agenda forward. And we have to look to develop unique partnerships such as the University Mayo Partnership and others, and we'll talk about a little more about those tomorrow as well. At this point, I'd ask Professor Eckert to pick up and give you a couple of specific examples.
Mr. Chairman and the committee, thank you for the opportunity to talk to you today. So nanotechnology is a new emerging scientific principle that is impacting many areas of science and research at the University of Minnesota and elsewhere. It's one of the most heavily funded research areas. Actually, it's second only to cancer from the federal funding sources. And an example is the NIH has quadruple funding in this area between the years of 2000 and 2004. Now, nanotechnology, because of its implications, actually spans many disciplines, and it utilizes and leverages the teaching and research infrastructure at the University of Minnesota. And more importantly, it does so across multiple colleges. And this is a strength and a challenge at sometimes to make it really happen. Historically, we've been a very strong leader in nanotechnology. We have a top 10 funding from the NSF, for example, in nanotechnology. And recently, there's a report called from Small Times, which is an industry ranking system where we are ranked 9th in funding and 2nd in nanotechnology and industry relations. That was from last year. I think that it would be important to pause for a moment and say that although nanotechnology is now, shall we say, in the mind share of a lot of people, it's actually been practiced at this in the state of Minnesota by companies like 3M, Seagate, and IBM for many years.
If I could just stop you for a second. Do you have a question, Representative Heaven?
Yes, Mr. Chair, a very basic question. Could you go into a little bit more detail about what exactly nanotechnology is
sure.
for those of us who don't have the doctor in front of our names?
Sure. So nanotechnology is the use of small principles in products and in materials due to the size of the particles or the process. So an example is the use of small particles to coat your material. Many of our fabric is actually coated with nanoparticles. And because of the size of the particles, it actually makes the material, the fabric, now resistant to water and makes it water resistant. Nanotechnology is really the appreciation that physics is a function of the size of the material we use. And it's a new physics. That is, it's a new physics that's really been hitting in the research world in the last 20 years. So I'm being vague because nanotechnology is really that fundamental question. It's a fundamental issue of physics. I'll point out that it allows the opportunity to make the super fast computers we use and the super high capacity hard drives that Seagate uses. It's all because of the properties of nanotechnology that allows you to do it. Another way to look at it is it allows you to do things that are differently in processes and pathways that have not been possible before. It's a classic case of an emerging technology.
If I could just use an example that might give you an idea of the size scale we're talking about. The size scale of the molecules or particles that Steve has referred to, if you were to compare that to the size of a soccer ball, it'd be the same comparison as comparing the size of that soccer ball to the Earth in terms of size. So we're talking about remarkably small particles which have been able to be organized in ways to actually create micro machines and allow us to do things in the body that up to this point in time, as an example, have had to rely on external devices to do. So it's really, really very, very small scale science. But as Steve said, because of the change in scale, all of the physics and all of the chemistry and all of the molecular biology involved is an entirely different set of principles, which is why it needs to be developed and researched at a university like this. It's new ground.
And if I could add for the committee, I was at a conference, sales pitch, whatever you want to call it, this group from nanotechnology, and I walked in thinking I'd see about 15 companies represented, and there was probably 115 companies represented there. So it is really a very growing and huge industry.
It's a transformative industry.
The sad thing is that what I hear, incidentally, is that Wisconsin's a little farther ahead of us than we would like, and be something this committee should deal with.
So I wanted to continue with the next phase of Nano is actually the application of it for biological and biosciences. And that is an emerging field that's really hit critical mass in the last 5 years. So nanotechnology is in our computer hard drives that is driving the PowerPoint presentation we're seeing right now. The use of nanotechnology for the next medical device, the next MRI instrument for when you go in to do a cancer checkup, that's going to happen over the next 10 years. And we have in Minnesota a very unique combination of groups. We have a fantastic comprehensive cancer center. We have an outstanding institute of technology in nanotechnology. And those key pieces need to be able to work together to make and employ these tools to give you the next diagnostics, the next treatments for health in the state of Minnesota and elsewhere. We are really at a critical phase in terms of decision making. I can tell you that other universities in the Big Ten are heavily investing in nanobiotechnology. It is. They look at it as a significant growth industry for their institutions.
Thank you.
Members of the committee, if I could, I would introduce Professor Art Erdman, one of our preeminent faculty in the Department of Mechanical Engineering and an innovator and an entrepreneur who will talk to you about the important convergence of technology and biology in important applications for the state.
Thank you, Chair McHoney and committee members. The chair may remember a couple years ago that you were kind enough to be at our Design and Medical Devices Conference and President's Conference on Medical Devices. You're getting a copy of the advertisement for this coming year. This is a conference that we held about every year since 2001, and you'll see there are sponsors on there. We've been able to raise over $400,000 from sponsors that have gone into the graduate fellowship fund at the university and matched by the university.
I do actually remember it because it was the conference that I went to wearing jeans and a flannel shirt, not expecting to be on a board, on a discussion board. So it was rather amusing for most everybody but me.
Well, we fully appreciated your comments and insight, and we had really good discussions on that. Now, I joined the university in 1971. By 1972, I started working across the street with the Academic Health Center, which Frank runs. I started with dentistry and then into orthopedics, and then over the years I worked with cardiology and urology, neuroscience, ENT, ophthalmology, and it's just a wonderful place to be. I just love coming to work every day. We have wonderful students, and my favorite thing is to meet up with a doc on campus or a industry need that seems really impossible in the health sciences and go after it, form a team, and try to solve some problems. It's been really exciting. I'm going to talk about one of those today. It's a project that we had with 3M Company for 4 years. I can't tell you much about what we developed because it's part of a couple of patents, real patents, that says provisional there. But it's a next generation stethoscope. So you can kind of imagine what you might want to learn from that stethoscope more than what your heartbeat happens to be. And it resulted in a PhD and a postdoc. If you go to the next slide. We happen to be on the cover of a University of Minnesota Foundation report. This is a team we formed. Dr. Kupik from electrical engineering, Marie Dion in the center. She did all the hard work, actually supervised three or four other master's students, and KP Madu from cardiology. and it was a wonderful project that yielded lots of new technology. We're actually having a conference call with 3M tomorrow about the possibility of going to the next stage in this. It's a wonderful opportunity at the university that maybe it's been said before, but I always emphasize, you know, the Institute of Technology and the health sciences are just across the street from one another. Not too many universities enjoy that opportunity, and it's so important. It, to get an hour of a doc's time is important, and if we both have an hour, then you have 50 minutes that is useful work, and this is really makes things happen at the University of Minnesota. And in closing, I just say that one of the problems that we have as faculty, I have many colleagues, about 70 colleagues that are doing biomedical research, projects similar to this. One of the projects we have is we can't keep our students long enough. The master's and PhD students are being hired out from under us before they finish their work. And we're trying to use this conference to bring in new students to the university to do this kind of research, and very, very pleased to be part of this system. Thank you.
Are there any questions for the witness? I have just one myself, and you're partnering with 3M on this particular piece of equipment. You partner with 3M in a significant number outside of just this particular one? I mean, do they have a fairly large presence at the U?
Oh, absolutely. I know, for example, in the dental school, 3M has been sponsoring dental research. They have a chewing machine, which is a robotic device built out of an MTS, which is a company in town, technology.
Is that for children in broccoli? Or,
no? They probably do. They
swallowing machine.
Not my favorite vegetable, but they test out various ceramics. They test out all sorts of things. So a colleague that I've occasionally worked with over there, and there are many, many other projects. And of course, we have support from Medtronic and St. Jude and Boston Scientific, many of these type of projects.
Well, Doctor, and I don't know who this should be directed to, but it would be delightful for myself, and I'm sure the committee members would like to see some of a list of the companies that we partner with, particularly if they're Minnesota companies. We're going to make this a nonpartisan committee, but we might be very parochial.
Chair Mahoney, we'll try to have some of that information for you in tomorrow's presentation, which will focus on our academic corporate partnerships.
Thank you.
I'd like to pick up now, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, where Professor Erdman left off on his story to you about the retention of graduate students that we train, in this case in biomedical engineering, which is in part key to the future of the biosciences, and it has a lot to do with where the Board of Regents and President Brunix are steering the university now under strategic positioning. And with that, I would like to mention that Board of Regent member Hunter is with us today, and thank him for his attendance and support. It has a lot to do with what is the value added by being a top three public research institution. And these lists of reasons, I'm not going to talk to them about all of them, but there is an important concept that's underneath this. It's all about quality and excellence. And quality and excellence translates into the global and national competitiveness that the state of Minnesota needs to retain itself on the forefront of being the envy of the world for the titanium device industry, and becoming the envy of the world in the development of biotechnology. It's really the faculty of the research university that drive the innovation that does that, and that requires the university being a destination of choice for those faculty to come to and to stay in. And that ties back to this concept that if we're producing the brightest and the best PhD students or professional students, we need the ability to retain. That's all about the two pieces you'll hear thematically recur the need for investment in facilities and faculty at this great research university. Great faculty attract great students. Great students attract great faculty. That's what creates the environment of innovation, and as Vice President Mulcahy showed you, produces the innovative new ideas that can create jobs in the state of Minnesota through new companies, which is where most of the jobs come. And Representative Mahoney has referred to the growing nanotechnology industry in the state of Minnesota, which is truly remarkable, as well as our evolving biotechnology industry. We really want Minnesota not to be the flyover state, but to be the state you fly to. I think that's called a tagline, but it's a pretty good one. Now, if we go a little further, what the left-hand column of this slide does is it shows you the industrial strength in biosciences of the state of Minnesota. Medical devices, pharmaceuticals, the agro-bio industry, medical diagnostics, food science. It then shows you the strength of the university in that column next to it. Health sciences, foods, neurosciences, nano, IT, renewable energy. It's no mistake that these two columns go together. That's the importance of a research university, and nationwide it's very clear. Those communities that are clustered around research universities have an economic leg up. What we're saying to you, and tying back to the Pardee study, the question was raised about, is if we want to sustain our growth and grow as an area for biotechnology, we need investment now. If I go on and do a little more analysis here and bring in the concept of convergence, I think we'll get to this slide and a new concept. What Professor Erdman and Professor Ecker were demonstrating to you is an incredibly important principle. It's the convergence of knowledge that becomes synergistic in the creation of new innovative ideas that translate into patents, companies, and jobs. So you heard nano. Nano, millionth of an inch? Billionth of an inch. God, I'm off a 10 to the 3 myself. It's incredibly small. It's the ability to take one of these little chips. You probably saw this movie. You put it in the bloodstream and it'll target a tumor cell and set off a bomb and kill it.
Could you rephrase that?
It's a very small bomb.
And it can go wherever it wants. So I think it's this convergence of ideas and concepts between engineering, physics, chemistry, and the health sciences as one example in medicine, nursing, pharmacy, that is where the strength of the university now is, and is the strength that we need to capture and move out into the private sector for the good of the entire state. And we'll come back to that concept. And this idea that about convergence is it requires interdisciplinary strength. And that's what we've tried to illustrate to you this morning. In the past, we've been very successful at this. Through the food industry, we're one of the centers of the food and grain industry. Think of the names. I mean, Pillsbury is just one example. General Mills. That's all related to this convergence of what was in the university, what was in the private sector. The development of iron and taconite in the state of Minnesota is just another example. The discoveries that drove the medical device industry, starting with the pacemaker and the heart-lung machine. That's past.
Dr. Sarah, did you have a question?
I do have a question, and I don't mean to stop you midway. I couldn't get the chair's attention a minute ago. I'm sorry. Could you, as you're talking about the convergence issue, one of the pieces of new terminology that we're hearing a lot is bioinformatics. And I don't see that anywhere on here, and I'm wondering how does bioinformatics, or does it, play a role in all these listings that you have, and particularly the convergence?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this is a very important question. The university is very strong in the spectrum of bioinformatics, which on one end is how you make models and visualize them in three dimensions to design new drugs or new ways of doing things, and on the other end is health informatics. The most common thing you hear about is the electronic health record. We didn't specifically put informatics in here, even though acknowledging it's a discipline in its own right, and we have it as a graduate discipline. It's really a platform that this convergence of the sciences uses to make the innovation happen. So rather than list for you the platforms, of which bioinformatics is an incredibly important one, we just chose to do it this way.
Thank you. That helps.
Please continue.
What's going on now? The present. Well, these are just three examples. Carbovir, this drug that is benefiting millions and millions of people who suffer from AIDS worldwide. The PRRS vaccine. This is a vaccine for respiratory virus in pigs, which is a major industry in the state of Minnesota. This vaccine was developed at the veterinary school in conjunction with what at that time was the ag school in the management of a principal meat production problem around pork. U Special Kids, which is really focusing on the management of chronic diseases in kids. The other thing we're doing now, I could go on with a long list, is making investments in the biosciences for the future. And you'll see some of that come out in this next slide about what we think the promise of these investments is going to be. An effective treatment of Alzheimer's. We already have the new imaging systems that are non-invasive and going into clinical testing. Better diagnosis, better ability to treat and develop cures. An effective treatment for compulsive gambling. Major problem in the state of Minnesota. There's actually a new drug in development to do this. Robots to clear landmines or undertake other hazardous duties. Very well developed in the Institute of Technology. Adult stem cells that can repair damaged hearts and cure diabetes. We're very close to this cure for diabetes. We're not there, but we're close. Cars running on hydrogen made from biomass. Another major potential agricultural crop for the state of Minnesota. This is what we can do if we have the investment.
And I'll pick up from my colleague and just mention to you that what we want to transition a little bit now is not just our innovation and contributions that we make through our technologies, but let's look at the impact the university has statewide in other ways in terms of employees and employers. We've completed a couple of different alumni surveys at the university in the last year, and I'm just going to highlight for you some of the important data here. First of all, shown on this map, obviously, are the five campuses of the University of Minnesota, including the developing and evolving campus in the Rochester area. We have 18 regional extension offices, which take a lot of what we do at the university and put it in hands of everyday people in ways that can benefit what they're trying to do, whether it's on the farm or whether in a small business or whether in some public service component in these various regions throughout the state. We have 13 research and outreach centers that connect scholars and people in ways, everyday people. It's things as simple as how to improve your gardening, which to some people is just a tremendous benefit and something they view the university is making a very important contribution to. We also have 65,000 students in 2006, which includes graduate students and professional students who quite honestly become the drivers of the whole innovation economy and the healthcare economy for the state. So we're a very important contributor outside of our technical areas as well. When thinking about the impact of the university, many people think about just our intellectual property, the technology we develop and license and market. But I think it's more important to think about the benefit of the university by thinking about its intellectual capital, not its intellectual property. And under intellectual capital, there are many, many components. Students, who are really the highly educated workforce that benefit the companies and businesses in the state of Minnesota and nationwide. Alumni who are very, very important, lifelong contributors to the state. These are successful people across the board who give back to the community, give back to the university, give back to the state in many, many ways. Our faculty, as we've already pointed out, are our innovators. They serve as consultants and experts for business and industry across the state. So beyond their role as educators and researchers in their university function, they have a profound impact outside of the university. The university offers facilities, unique equipment and expertise that are routinely accessed by businesses throughout the state. We have knowledge dissemination in terms of teaching. We have knowledge creation, as I mentioned, in terms of our research. And tomorrow we'll talk more about this other component of intellectual capital, a smaller piece but an important piece, how we commercialize technology, how we move it from idea and concept to hands-on delivery of product. Now, I'd also like to mention, just to give you an idea of the impact of students and alumni of the university across the state, this is the results of one of our most recent surveys. And you can see, based on the survey we conducted, there were 10,000 companies formed by university alumni in the state of Minnesota, and another 9,000 companies by alumni across the nation. Each of these companies averages 60 to 70 employees. So you can see a really profound economic impact beyond what Dr. Sierra and I can articulate well for you in terms of individual concepts and individual technologies. These companies employ 500,000 people in Minnesota and another 600,000 nationally. So they represent a huge source of employment, and they generate $100 billion in annual revenues in Minnesota, not to mention the $130 billion nationally. So you can see that the reach, the impact of the university is broad and deep, and it touches each and every one of us here in this room and across the state of Minnesota. Just a couple of examples of technologies or companies that have come out of the university. This is one that's actually doing very, very well. This is Nanocopia. It's a nanotech company that takes advantage of nanotech applications to create advanced coatings, drug formulations, and various converging industries of devices, drugs, and delivery. So it's a perfect example of the kind of convergence that occurred at the university, was spun out into a company, and now this company is having an impact in the devices area, drug area, and coatings area. Another one that's very, very interesting, and it's Nature North Technologies, which is in the northern part of the state, and what they've actually been able to do is identify very active compounds, drugs, and different chemicals in the bark of the white paper birch tree. And in fact, we are still finding multiple applications of these new drugs and their use, or new compounds in their use in industry and in health. And this company, Nature North Technologies, is a direct extension of that kind of discovery, which was made by faculty initially at the University of Minnesota. Finally, let me just give you, admittedly, these trying to make an impact statement on research on employment is tough because it is based on a large number of assumptions. And rather than impose on you the assumptions that the University of Minnesota would apply in a case like this, I'll rely on the United States Department of Commerce and work with numbers that they would use. University expenditures across the country totaled $32.2 billion in 2001, and that's the last year for which we have these various estimators calculated. It's not us, but nationally that's the last time they were done. It translated into about 1 million jobs, and so the implication here is that there's really about 32 jobs per $1 million in R&D at universities. And if you just apply that strictly to the dollars we have received at the University of Minnesota, you can see it accounts directly for 19,200 jobs in 2005. So not only do we create and train people who go out and are themselves employers of many, the university itself, through its own research activity locally, contributes significantly to job employment.
We do have significant challenges, and it's probably worth, at this point, just listing some of these for you. because you need to help us solve some of these challenges. Right now, the federal funding for research, which is primarily basic research, that new discovery kind of research, is flat, which means it's actually going down by the rate of inflation. And what that means is not that there isn't a lot of money, but we have to compete for it now in a different way. When the NIH, as an example, was doubling its budget, we competed very well, and we grew at the same rate. What we need to do now to retain what we have and grow is compete with the other universities who are looking for the same grant source as we are. That's marketplace competition. That's exactly what it is. And right now, our competing schools are being out-invested. They're getting more investment than we are. And that's that Pardee message. So if we want to stay in this race, if we want to win this race, because that's the only reason to stay in it, we need the investment in the facilities and the faculty to do the job. We lack that 21st century research space. You've heard about the Biomedical Facilities Authority. You'll hear more about it. But we need to build a 125,000 square foot building for this kind of research every other year for four more of them. And we need, you're going to hear more about that, and each one of those facilities will house 40 principal investigators, 140 support personnel, which would get us well on the way to hiring the 300 new faculty we need over the next 10 years to be competitive. We need to internally do more to foster collaboration between disciplines. This is a major strategic positioning effort of the President, the Provost, myself, Vice President Mulcahy, and the Board of Regents, and we're putting the resources together to do that, and I'll tell you something, it's exactly what the faculty want to do, which is one way you should judge the effectiveness of research administration. If they're tuned into whether their faculty want to go and research, they're doing the right things, because the faculty drive the research agenda. We need better partnerships with the private sector. You're going to hear more about this with Vice President Mulcahy tomorrow, about new ways of engaging with business. You heard from BioBiz, you heard from Life Science Alley. What's not commonly known is we cross-subsidize federal research money. And actually, in research, the feds are the best payer. But for every dollar of federal money we get, we have to find another 25 to 30 cents. They'll tell you that point out. They pay for about 65-70% of the direct and indirect cost of doing research. Traditionally, that's where we've relied on the state, and for facilities and the like, and our other major source of revenue is, of course, our practice plans. So we need these investments to grow. We've done a lot of work prioritizing. Rather than saying we look like a flat egg, we want to say, here's where our faculty have said we're going to grow. And we've done that. We're defining these areas of growth. You've heard about nanomedical technology. You've heard about biomedical sciences, and if you look at these lists, those are the other areas we've looked at. We've redone some more of these platforms to get back to that concept so we can take these new technologies and in the health area get them into the clinical trials that are necessary to get the value added so somebody will purchase that and start a new company and so on. We're learning how to leverage our research strengths. We're making smart investments. You've all heard about genomics. When genomics came along, there was a request by about 100 faculty from IT and the Academic Health Center to make a major investment. We invested $2 million in that technology and the training of faculty. That investment had a return on investment of $30 million at 3 years. We're doing the same now in bioinformatics. where Vice President Mulcahy and I have made another $2 million investment in improving the technology that we have in-house and in the educating and training of faculty so they can use that more in their research grant applications. We're setting performance expectations for research. The faculty are leading this, and we're continuing the development of the University Mayo Partnership, about which you will hear more tomorrow, about how that success has occurred.
Thank you, Frank. One of the things I'm, some of my colleagues don't appreciate my saying, but you know, I make this comment that as academics, we not only think we know the answer, many times we're pretty sure we know the question. And therefore, we develop answers to questions that we think are important, but in fact may not be important to some key constituency. So tomorrow we'll talk more in detail about our university corporate relations effort, but I want to insert in here a little bit of information to show you what we're hearing from our corporate partners as what they want to see and what they value from the university as an economic partner. And so when we were setting up this Academic and Corporate Relations Center, which I'll elaborate on tomorrow, one of the first things I said was we need to ask companies, what do they want us to do? How do they view us? What can we do for them? So we asked them, what are the most important assets at the university from the perspective of your company? And this is a hierarchy of need that were generated from this survey. The survey was of 30 companies across the state, 15 from the Twin Cities area, and 15 from greater Minnesota. And the responses were fairly consistent. What they value most are our students and the educational opportunities that we present for their employees in terms of continuing education, consortium workshops and seminars like the one that Dr. Erdman referred to, access to our scientific expertise of our faculty, the opportunity to develop new basic research at the university, and then finally to purchase or to transact intellectual property. So as I've mentioned to you before, frequently we think of intellectual property as what companies are most interested in, coming to the university and licensing our technologies. But in fact, what they told us was, again, they're more interested in our intellectual capital. So we have to really finance, we have to strategize across the university to be sure that we continue to prioritize the needs beyond the technical, but actually go to the continuing education and the workforce issues. I paraphrased a couple of the comments that came across very consistently. First of all, companies across the region indicated that the success of the university is vital to their own success. Many of you probably do not know, but before I came to Minnesota 2 years ago, I was at the University of Wisconsin, and one of the things that really surprised me and delighted me when I arrived here was how avid the corporate partners in the state of Minnesota are for their relationship with the university. We didn't have to convince those companies that we're important to them. They recognize the importance, and in fact, they've come to us and said, the university is critical to us. We need to find more effective ways to work with you. So one of the things that I would say is the relationship between the corporate community and the university is very, very strong here and something that we have to be sure that we continue to nurture and sustain. The university obviously supplies a lot of basic knowledge, but again, companies believe that our greatest value is well-educated and trained talent for the workforce.
Now, a few more words about the workforce, because investing in the production of this innovation without the workforce to make it a reality gives us a big problem. So the first comment I want to make is we are part of the workforce production in the state of Minnesota. We're complementary with what Minsky does and what the private institutions do. So I'm going to speak a little bit more about our unique contributions to the workforce that will support the biosciences in the state of Minnesota. In 2004 and 2005, there were 44,333 degrees from public and private institutions in the state of Minnesota. The Twin Cities campus of the university produced 29% of all these degrees, public and private. I think what's important for this discussion is the STEM degrees. These are science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. This is what that survey Vice President Mulcahy was talking about. This is what the industry in Minnesota told us they needed. This is also the national priority. We produced 46% of all those STEM degrees in the state of Minnesota in 2004 and 5. That includes 100% of all PhDs in engineering, 100% of all PhDs in mathematics, 100% of all PhDs in the physical sciences, 95% of all PhDs in computer sciences, and 78% of all PhDs in the biological and medical sciences, with the Mayo Clinic producing the rest. So it gives you some idea of where we are in producing the workforce that actually drives this engine. If we then go on and talk a little bit more about health workforce, we produce 70% of the health workforce of the state of Minnesota for physicians, nurses, pharmacists, public health people, dentists, and veterinarians. We educate students actually in over 1,700 sites in the state of Minnesota, with the idea then, if you attract students from those communities, you train them in those communities, they'll stay in those communities, and in fact, that's exactly what happens. Now, the vision for what's going on there really has three components. To assure that the vital health professions workforce is there. And we do that in partnership with the privates, but more importantly for us, with the Minsky system. I'll give you an example. The northeastern part of Minnesota, as most of greater Minnesota, is classified federally as dentally disadvantaged. Greater Minnesota is also classified as disadvantaged for pharmacy services and for medical services, particularly mental health. So, we went up to Hibbing and worked with, at that time, Hibbing Community and Technical College, which had space. We had some funding from you. They had some additional funding. We worked with the elected officials, and we worked with the dental community, the professional community, and we opened what is now called the Hibbing Dental Clinic. In the 3 years it's been open, it has seen 22,000 patients that never saw a dentist before. That's incredible. It's also a self-sustaining financial model. It's also restored what is Hibbing Community and Technical College, now I think called Hibbing Community College. It's restored their program in dental technicians, which was ready to fold, and now it is overflowing with candidates. What is also important is at last count, there were 11 dentists who finished that program who are now practicing in greater Minnesota. And that goes up every year. We find the same results from our Rural Physician Associate Program, which puts upwards of 40 students a year in greater Minnesota working with primary care physicians. They actually live with them and practice with them for 9 months. And most of those individuals end up practicing in greater Minnesota. And you can go on for pharmacy, etc. Second concept. We're working with communities to improve the health of those communities, and we do that on something that's called an AHAC platform. This is a federally funded platform of area health education centers, and we have a network across the state of Minnesota. What's required is a local 501c3, which the Board of Regents grants, so it's self-governing community-based organization in regions around the state. And they achieve resources to do two things. Educate students about careers in the life sciences and start them on the pathway of getting into higher education, going right down into K-12. And the second thing they do is they bring university expertise to that community to work with the health problems that exist in that community, whether it's a public health prevention problem, or a new way of treating disease that's unique in that community or preventing disease. And thirdly, by attracting students to work in those communities so there is no health, workforce, and health status impediment to the economic development of those communities. What we're now doing is partnering with the Extension Service and bringing additional university expertise to communities on these platforms throughout the state of Minnesota. In summary, three summation statements. One, developing the bioeconomy requires partnerships with the university, Mayo Clinic, the private sector, and the public sector to make this a reality across the state of Minnesota. I think when you hear a major investment report that you've made in the UMayo partnership tomorrow, you'll get a very clear message that, in fact, we can deliver those goods. We just need the investment to do it. Secondly, the university is the knowledge engine. It provides substantive and sustained innovation into the potential to create new jobs, new companies in the state of Minnesota. You'll hear more about how we're moving to do that more efficiently and effectively, again, as you'll hear Vice President Mulcahy develop, by listening to our partners as to what we're doing wrong and what they need from us. You've heard from BioBiz and you've heard from Life Science Alley. The other big players around are the Minnesota High Tech Council and MinNano, it's called, who are all involved in pushing the wheel ahead. We need the investments, public and private, and several reasons we need to know that. For us to recruit and retain faculty, we need to be able to plan. Recruiting and retaining this kind of quality means you got to look downstream. And I'll leave you with one example. We've made a major investment in the development of pharmaceuticals for the state of Minnesota. It's tied in with the Institute of Technology, it's tied in with the Cancer Center, all the health science schools, and yes, even the College of Biological Sciences. This is the recruitment of Professor Gunda Georg. This recruitment took 3 years and $22 million to accomplish. It will deliver the goods over the next 3, 4, 5 years, but we needed the ability to plan for those facilities and to develop the partnerships to develop the resources. And we need help from you, we need help from the private sector, and looking downstream, if you go back to this final diagram, this actually was one in the beginning that Vice President Mulcahy showed, it's a partnership to get from innovation to new company. You have a role, we have a role, the private sector has a role. I am absolutely convinced if we put our shoulder to the wheel, we can make it a reality in the state of Minnesota as a place people go because of the vibrant biosciences community that exists here. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we thank you for the opportunity to share this information with you. We have the four of us here. We'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have or request for information that you might have.
Well, I'd like to thank you for coming today and presenting this information to us. We can all get it in small bits and pieces, but it's nice to kind of have a layout as it goes forward and see where it somewhat connects. I'd like to open it up if there's some questions.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'd like to ask a couple things. First of all, it was alluded to earlier, the issue of not just retention of faculty and investment in facilities, but retention of the graduate students. You mentioned that you often lose your master's and PhD students, and it's disruptive to projects. Being a former academic myself, I'd like to hear you expand on it a little bit, on what are the problems that's creating that situation other than a vibrant market, which is a good thing in the private sector, but how can we address that as we move forward? We just certainly don't want to make these investments in faculty and buildings if our graduate students aren't completing their projects, so if you could elaborate on that a little bit.
Art, you want to start?
Sure. Fortunately, we're most of the...
Could you identify yourself?
Yes. I'm sorry, Art Erdman from Mechanical Engineering. Chair Mahoney and members of the committee. Fortunately, we have enough grab on these students that we get them to finish their work. I pointed out this fact as the demand in the community is so high, particularly in the Medtronics and the Boston Scientifics, that they are wanting these students earlier than originally was perhaps planned. And so what we as faculty members have to do is to continue to feed the pipeline and to, in my case actually, take some risks and bring in some students that we don't really have the funding for yet, but expecting that the funding will come.
Representative Bunn, one additional thing I'd mention is that I think you referred to an important point, is the situation you alluded to speaks to the need and demand for the skilled workforce. And it's so demanding at this point in time that companies are willing to recruit people out of their academic program to fill the need. When it speaks to the need to have greater capacity mm-hmm. to train those kind of individuals, and that would be addressed in a couple ways. One is additional facilities. Right now we couldn't add additional faculty to support more students if we wanted to. We need additional facilities. We also need the great faculty that we have to continue to attract the best students. And finally, a thing that the university is looking for, and it's an important piece of partnership, is finding innovative ways to partner with companies that give students the opportunity to complete their academic program while at the same time interfacing with the private side. So having internships or actually having industry investigators working with faculty investigators on collaborative projects that the student contributes to. We have a couple of programs like that in place. I think we'd like to see those expanded. Mm-hmm. But it does speak to addressing a critical need.
If I could add to Representative Mahoney, Representative Bunn, another problem we are solving, and you will see in the university's biennial requests. Our salaries for graduate students and our funds to support graduate students are not competitive with our peer institutions. I'll just be candid about it. We're doing a whole lot to put together the recurring dollars to improve that. To make it worse, places like the NIH are restricting more and more what you can pay for graduate students on their grants, and frankly, right now, a graduate student is more expensive than a postdoc. Mm-hmm. So Provost Sullivan, myself, Vice President Mulcahy, under the direct directive of the President, have been investing dollars each year, and a chunk of that comes out of the biennial request. You'll see more of that in there, along with funds to increase the competitiveness of our faculty salaries, which is essential if you're going to compete in this market. We're also under, again, the capable leadership of our president and a very strong statement of the Board of Regents, doing what we can do with philanthropy to raise money for scholarships and fellowships. We have taken these Ziogen royalties, which are substantive, and turn most of them, or a big part of them, because I can't remember the actual percentage, back into matching funds for graduate students and teaching assistants. So we're beginning to do a lot of things to make those salaries competitive, to make the faculty salaries competitive, to enrich the environment that these students actually are educated and trained in. There's nothing more discouraging to a graduate student when they don't have the most recent state-of-the-art equipment to learn on. I'll just throw that out. I think you would understand that. If you're going to put yourself out there as the place to go to get trained, you better have the cutting-edge stuff to do the training on, or you'll lose the game. And so I think your question is right on the mark. It's those graduate students that are key to the future. And those are some of the things we're doing. If anybody has more suggestions, we're open.
Thank you.
Dr. Sarah, there's a couple other questions, but the prerogative of the chair is to ask one first, ask a request. Could you put together some comparative, your number 8 or number 15? What are the other 15 paying their graduate students so that we have a field of reference? And you can put all the, how shall I say it? When you put together a salary package, sometimes there's actual salary on the check, and then there's a bunch of other stuff. So put it all together as an aggregate number, and so we can
compare. Total compensation.
There you go.
Yes, sir.
With that, Representative Norton.
Thank you, Representative Mahoney. Members, I had two questions. The first, and there's such an overlap between the work we're doing here and certainly the Higher Ed and Workforce Development Committee, of which I'm on, so there may be some overlap in my desire to have these answers. The first had to do with your explanation of the Hibbing Dental Clinic, and some of my rural friends were bemoaning the, I'm not sure if you called it a dental deficiency, but the need for dentists in rural Minnesota. And I think that's just an excellent example of what can happen. My question, I'm anticipating this question from some of my constituents. What has made your program successful, and why is this a better model than a private sector? And do you see what I'm getting at? Why has the private sector been unable to sustain a dental clinic in these and other areas when you noted that it's self-sustaining at this point? Do you anticipate competition? Do you anticipate rolling out and letting private industry take in, or are we just thrilled that this is working and we're going to replicate it across the state? That's one.
Chair Mahoney and Representative Norton, it's a very good question. I should say questions, which I will give you some candid answers to, because I think the answers are important to this question. I use the terminology dentally disadvantaged, which is a federal terminology, meaning there aren't enough dentists per population.
Yep.
In that setting, what happens is, with the cost of dental practice, they adjust their case mix so they can stay alive, and in business, as a private business, while providing as much dental care to the disadvantaged as possible. In the current workforce that existed in Greater Minnesota, the workforce was simply not there to take care of a large proportion of Medicaid patients or non-insured dental patients. That was a need we saw. So that's the first answer to your question. I think it makes it a public sector need, if I were to tell the truth. And clearly that's our land-grant mission, as it is with the Minsky system. So we accepted that responsibility, which gets me to answer number two. About 8 years ago, we, the Academic Health Center and the university, put together what we call the Greater Minnesota Workforce Strategy. I actually have an update of that, which I will be sending to each of you probably within the next week. But we recognize these workforce deficiencies, and we also work with MNSCU, particularly Northwest Minnesota in this particular case, to understand them better by doing some marketing studies as to what was needed and what were we actually supplying in nursing, pharmacy, various forms of medicine, and so on. And around that, we crafted a strategy, and that's what you funded in part. The expansion of our nursing program in Rochester to meet that demand. The expansion of our pharmacy program in the University of Minnesota Duluth to meet that demand. Those programs are both very successful. We chose a different tact with the Hibbing Dental Clinic, but again, the state stepped up as a partnership. It put money on the table. And now we're opening a similar one in Wilmer with help from the Health Department, Department of Human Services. There's another one planned in Fergus Falls. We have a roving dental truck that goes community to community and performs a lot of dental procedures. So part of what I'm saying to you is this was part of a planned program with partnerships that are public to public and public private. So we do a lot with Fairview. We do a lot with St. Mary's Duluth Clinic. We do a lot with Merit Care, and so on and so forth around the state. This Hibbing financial model, to get to the third one, is a shared risk, shared resource model. So that the university has some dollars in there, the state has some dollars in there, the Human Services Department through its Medicaid reimbursement has dollars in there, and so on, and it's a financially viable model. I will tell you straight out, there is not the margin in here that I think the private sector would compete for this business. And it's really the kind of thing that we do in our programs. If you recall the dental school, the last 2 years of the four-year degree is all practice, and it occurs in the dental school, and it's all with Medicaid patients, because that's where the demand is for the dental services, and that's where we think our mission is. So those are my three levels of response. Are we there yet? Have we limited the federal designation? No. You've heard more, and you'll hear more in the university's biennial request about the Center for Allied Health Programs. Again, partnering with MNSCU, in this case Winona, to get it up on its feet, but eventually other MNSCU schools, to expand the production of laboratory scientists, medical technologists, occupational therapists, and so on, to meet the state's demand. So we've developed this comprehensive program. We've done it in partnerships. It's moving ahead, and you'll get a report with all the numbers.
I appreciate the thorough response and for getting to my multiple levels of questions. My last one is short, I think. I raised this the other day as well. In Rochester, we had a workforce development meeting recently, and one of the messages that came out of that was we can have the great research facilities, but we're not necessarily producing entrepreneurs, people with a business background, in order to take your outcome and move it forward into the private sector. Could you address that just briefly?
Yes, I would, and then see if my colleagues have additional things. And actually, I'm remiss here in the interest of full disclosure, because prior to this, when I was saying hello to Representative Mahoney, chair of the committee, he said, "Don't you have something going on in the Carlson School of Management?" And I said, "Yes, of course, I'll mention it in my presentation," which, of course, I failed to remember to do. So I will now bring it up now. When we work with the Carlson School of Management to bring the Masters of Health Administration back into the Academic Health Center, which has an entrepreneurial component, all of us working on this project felt very strongly that there was a need for an entrepreneurial degree at the MBA level to manage biotechnology companies. There's a third one that probably Professor Ehrman can tell you more about than I can. The Institute of Technology has a specific degree program in entrepreneurial management. Did you want to say a few words about that?
Thank you, Frank. Chair Mahoney, committee members, we have a graduate course, 9-month course, that we have offered now for 11 years. It's called New Product Design and Business Development. The faculty teaching this course are from the Institute of Technology, from the Medical School, and the Carlson Business School. The deliverables at the end are a business plan, working prototype, and about 30 other deliverables. The teams of students are second-year MBA students and engineering graduate students. And this is a company-sponsored course, which is very exciting. We've maybe had 7 or 8 patents come out of the course. There are products on the market that have come out of this course, and 3M products. I don't have one with me, but if you know a highlighter with a little full tab, and you can get those at Office Max, that's an idea that came out of that course. So we've been working hard on it, and there are about 9 faculty that are involved in this course. And it's an example of going after innovation. And we make sure that at least half of the projects are biomedical in nature.
Well, and that would be something, I guess, that you'll have to work hard to get them to bring that down to the University of Minnesota Rochester also.
Yeah.
I think there is a Representative Hans?
My question has kind of been answered in and about, but let me try it again for my own understanding. When we're talking about normal or past tense and past tradition for job growth and economic development in an area, the usual largest source of job growth was within old businesses. When you're giving your presentation today, the emphasis is to the new businesses. Isn't there a missing link to the expansion, the reinvention, or the evolution of the old business in the field of bioscience?
Chair Mahoney, Representative Haas, that's a great question. In fact, we probably should have emphasized that to a greater extent. One of the things that we, the university, does probably, I think, even better than generate new businesses or spin out new opportunities is actually work with our corporate partners to enrich and enhance their competitiveness, to provide the kind of workforce that they're needing. So there is a very, very big role in the reshaping of new business. And I would even say, and perhaps I'm misinterpreting your question, but it's not simply the small business that I'm referring to here in terms of transformative evolution. It's even the big companies. I look at the medical device industry as an example, which is a mainstay in the state of Minnesota. That particular industry is undergoing fundamental changes from the traditional devices, and my colleague here could speak much more fluently to this, but what's happening is that because of these convergences, because of the evolution of nanotechnology, because of the evolution in material sciences, that whole industry is beginning to recognize that they can make devices that do things that were only imaginings as recently as 5 years ago. So the university is contributing to the reformation, the retooling, and the evolution of existing businesses and industries as well. We obviously have technologies which are transformative, which is they themselves are not something that an established company would be interested in because it's not necessarily in their space. But what we have an obligation is to spin those new opportunities out, and I'll talk about that in more detail tomorrow. But you're absolutely right. It's not simply new businesses. It's helping established businesses evolve. And if I think you refer back, and I obviously was not here for the BioBusiness Alliance of Minnesota's presentation, but I'm familiar with their data. If you look at that data, what it really said was that the strong industries in the state are very, very vulnerable now because there hasn't been that connection to the basic research that they need to know how to evolve or what's the next thing coming down the pike and be positioned competitively to do that. And I think that's where the university comes in, because we have that fundamental basic discovery gene, if you will, in our DNA. That's what we do. And we have to make that bridge to existing companies. So it's retooling of companies in the state. It's evolving new opportunities. It's developing new technologies and new startup companies. But all of it comes to the point of really contributing to the workforce, the growth of the workforce in the state of Minnesota.
Thank
you. Thank you. Thank you. I think I'm going to conclude there for today. I do have a couple of announcements and a question. I see that our two researchers from the respective caucuses were able to make it here today, so I wanted to make sure that they were got a chance to introduce themselves, and then I have a question for a couple of the representatives, so if I could.
Sure, my name is Mike Ballou, and I'll be covering the committee for the Republican Caucus research.
Thank you. I think Dan Kane is over there, and he'll be covering it for the
Yeah.
Thank you.
Over at the University at the Center for Transportation Studies.
And you flew back here to get, yeah, we appreciate that. I have one other question for Representative Pepin and Representative Howes. I asked if I read the St. Cloud paper and found out that I was the one that totally toasted the St. Cloud biozone. And I had asked you to work together. I'm hoping that we can sometime in the first week of February hear back from both of you and then maybe take some testimony shortly thereafter and turn over what we believe as a committee would be a good set of priorities for a biozone declaration no later than the middle of February. I don't want to hold up any community looking to expand its industrial base. So with that, unless there's any other questions, Committee stands adjourned. Thank you, members.